This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time. And this is about how we make money to write.
Joy.
I just sit in a room and count those pennies as they come in.
Oh my gosh, the cash is flying, flying around.
We do have to do a bit of a nod to Annabelle Smith and Jane Rawson. Those guys are incredibly, incredibly candid about money.
I love it.
And there's a real appetite for it. So let's kick off. Put you in the hot seat. Kate,
yes,
how do you make money?
How do I make my money? Well, first, I want to start this, and I know you and I have both been listening to the Starving Artist podcast, which is awesome. Shout out to them. And I want to talk about that phrase, which I think is either income transparency or day job transparency. So I'm going to start by saying the way that I am existing right now is because I have a partner who has a full-time job, and that income is basically supporting us. So that is my being totally transparent at the start. I did look back at the figures to see what I made. So I was only working part-time before I started the book gig. I was working 2 days a week because I had small kids, so I was kind of on maternity leave. But that first year when the book came out, so it came out on the 1st of August, I made just over $30,000 off book-related things. So my royalties, festival payments, talking in schools, that kind of stuff. The next year, which was the last financial year, I made like a third of that. So if that gives a sense of the cycles of how money comes about.
How does it even work? So you get royalties.
Yep.
So you have an advance, say. Then you get royalties. When do the royalties actually get paid?
Okay. So please, anyone who is actually good at this, like an agent or the ASA, you can just contact us and we'll put links to your services because you'll get this right. But so I had a $5,000 advance for Skylarking and I earned out that advance maybe before my first royalty statement. I'm not sure, but like I got paid then a $10,000 royalty statement within that first year. So I earned out my advance. So what I think sometimes people or writers new to the world don't understand is that you can get a really big advance, but your advance is an advance against your royalties. So you still have to earn it out effectively. So your royalties get paid at the end of a 6 month period, I think. Normally they would go through your agent, I think, first, but I don't have an agent. So I just get that little notice that says how many books I've sold, how many ebooks I've sold, how many books at ridiculous discounted rate have been sold, and then I get a check.
So you get a proportion of the discounted price or a proportion of recommended retail?
Yeah, I think that's all in people's contracts.
Okay.
And so it's a, you know, a certain amount of each of those things.
Yeah.
You can tell that I really take a lot of I pay a lot of attention. I certainly pay attention as it begins to diminish, that's for sure.
And what about libraries? How do libraries work?
Oh my gosh, this was the most exciting thing. Like I've been using libraries since I was, I don't know, 2 years old, right? Massive fan of libraries.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of
libraries. I did not realise that. I always felt kind of like a cheapskate getting books from the library because basically, you know, I couldn't afford to buy all the books I wanted.
It's also space. Like
space.
Money, definitely.
Oh my
but
gosh.
Also space.
Like, but this is the deal. Writers get paid a tiny, tiny little bit, but they still get paid when you borrow their books.
Is that how it works on borrows?
Yes, but it doesn't, it's kind of averaged out. So again, okay, we might link to this in the show notes where you can actually see how this works. But, and I think Annabelle Smith and Jane Rawson have spoken about this too, but it's basically a percentage. So they do a survey and then they pay you a small amount. But this year I did get my first PLR and ELR. So there's public lending rights from public libraries, and then there's also educational lending rights from schools and other institutions. And I get a little bit of that too because my book is studied in a number of schools. And that's just this awesome extra check that you get. And I know that for lots of people, especially who have a greater backlist of books, that check can be, you know, quite a significant proportion of their income, their book income for the year.
Right. And so what do you do alongside writing?
Writing. So at the moment, I'm a teacher by trade, so I also do some teaching related work in schools. I also speak about my book in schools, so those two things pay. I do some residencies. I teach adults as well. I'll do festivals or library gigs, and those kinds of things also help pay the bills. I do some school holiday workshops. So
do you do free stuff as well? Or do you try
to do free stuff? I do free stuff as well. And I think the first year I did everything I was asked. This year I've been a bit more savvy on making sure that if I'm doing free stuff, I say how much it's worth to make sure that I'm not undercutting other writers. So I'll actually send an invoice with the right amount that the ASA would recommend that talk was worth, and then I will write down less the discount or free, to make sure that I'm kind of supporting the community, I suppose. And I'll still do free gigs depending on what it is or who it's for. But my youngest will go to school next year, and I suppose I'm at the point of trying to work out how to make it all work. I also go for grants, and I've been successful with one grant, which bought me some time and money. But I think the thing to say is when I go to my accountant, I spend more each year on books and writing related events, training, travel, research at this stage than I am making off it.
Ouch.
Ouch. What about you, Catherine? What's your situation with the books and the money?
The books and the money. So I have sold my rights to, I sold text world rights. That would be over 12 months ago now. I got a 50% payment for the advance on signing. I've subsequently sold rights in the US, North America, the UK and Italy.
It's going to be in Italian.
It is pretty awesome. Can I say that? Yeah.
I think you can.
Mm, it is. It's a bit of a dream, really. But anyway, in terms of money, so each of those contracts would have attracted would have had an advance and a payment on signing. But I actually have seen nothing. The only thing that I have seen is a payment that on that original signing with text, less my agent's income. Because the way that it works is that techs recoup all their advance payments before you get anything.
Okay.
So
that's a little bit ouch as well.
It hurts. So I work as an engineer, basically. My husband's a teacher. He works 2 days a week. I work 3 days a week. And really that's what supports writing. Writing doesn't pay, you know.
It doesn't pay the bills.
I think I got $50 from Mamma Mia for an article once, and that's, you know.
Mamma Mia, pay more.
Yeah. Mm. yeah, so that's the only money that I've made.
We'll check back here in 12 months.
Yeah, and we'll see. We'll see where I'm at. I've also spent time applying for grants. Yep. I've not been successful with grants, OSCO and Creative Vic grants.
I heard someone say that you
have to. It's a demoralising experience.
It's totally demoralising. But I think there's two things that you get from it. I had a dear friend and mentor tell me once you've got to apply 6 times, and then,
law of averages
maybe is that you get one of them. But also that depending on where you are in your project, and I think this is really important because sometimes it can snuff a project out. But if you're at the right place in a project, that the act of applying is a really useful kind of a clarifying activity for your project.
Yeah.
Apply for all the grants, people.
But Kate, this is all a big setup, actually, Kate, because I have some ideas about how we are going to make some money together.
We're going to make money?
Yep.
This podcast is going to make us money?
Yeah, we're going to be rich. We're going to be rich. So For now, on with the show, but do stay tuned, dear listeners, for what happens next.
We are thrilled to welcome Mandy Brett to the First Time Podcast. Mandy Brett began her editing career as an editor and publisher at IAD Books, an Aboriginal publishing house in Alice Springs. Since then, she's worked as a freelance editor, as a production editor on a small magazine, and as a computer programmer for a time at Penguin Books. Mandy is now a senior editor with Text Publishing, where she has been since 2002. She works on fiction and non-fiction titles alike. Some examples are Claire Wright's Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, and recently Eva Hornung's The Last Garden. Her essays and speeches have appeared in Meanjin, Bookseller and Publisher, and Crikey, and she is often a guest lecturer in fiction editing at RMIT. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Mandy.
Very great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Mandy, we are about first times here on this podcast, and I wanted to ask you if you remember.
I'm too old to remember mine.
The first time you edited a book.
Oh, my God. The first time I edited a book. Well, I was working at IAD in Alice Springs, and it was an exceptionally fantastic place to learn to do the sort of work I now do, because we were dealing with writers who probably would not have made it through to a commercial publishing process. They might have been very, very first-time writers, or they might have been just basically oral historians or storytellers, not really writers in that sense at all. And so all of the stuff we did there was an exercise in listening as much as anything else, and being very attuned to people's level of confidence and their... the fact that they had a very strong sense of what they wanted to say, but not necessarily all the tools to do it in a kind of conventional writerly way.
So listening is a key quality in...
Well, listening to the writer and listening to the text as well, yeah. I mean, the text has got to sing to you. Part of the work we do as editors is to make it sing properly, sing in tune, I suppose.
What this was your first editing gig in Alice Springs? What attracted?
Well, I had worked in student media, so okay. I had done lots of work on the line. I mean, I knew that I had a kind of a bent for that. That was my thing.
And so you knew right from the outset that you wanted to edit. What attracted you to that?
No. I'm extremely lazy, lackadaisical sort of a person, and I was kind of like. I was attracted to that, and I thought probably it would suit me in some ways. I never felt particularly literary, and I had this sense of if you were going to work in book publishing, you had to be a very clued up literary, aesthetic sort of person.
And that's how people would consider you certainly now, but that's...
Perhaps they would. I'm not sure that's how I present to my nearest and dearest, but, actually, at uni, I was just like, oh, well, I've done all this student media and that was fun, and maybe I could get a job in publishing. And then I sort of researched a little bit how you went about getting a job in publishing. I'm like, they don't give them to anyone. That's no good. So that's when I went into computer programming instead.
Okay. So yeah. A bit of a side hustle in.
Well, I got a gig at Penguin, so it was kind of... But I never had that thing of, oh, and then I'll go into publishing. I was kind of like...
It happened.
This will pay reasonably well.
Yeah, you know. Which one needs as well.
Yeah, but that was the old days. Kids can't do that anymore. You've got to be really focused these days, apparently.
Well, you're now senior editor at Text.
I am.
What does your role encompass there?
Well, it encompasses pretty much everything in the process of publishing a book.
So acquisition.
To some extent strategy, I suppose, you know, what do we need more of on our list, that kind of thing. And then it on an individual title, I would do structural editing and copy editing and quite a lot of proofreading and liaison with the, you know, physical department, the production people and the cover designers and all that sort of stuff.
So there's a fair bit on your plate.
Yeah, but it's good. I mean, you do really get ownership of a project.
All the way through.
Not as much as the writer, obviously, but it's a very kind of it's a very kind of special collaboration with an author when you do the whole process. Yeah.
I really enjoyed watching a speech you gave at the Wheeler Centre, which I found on the YouTubes. We'll link to it in the show notes. And you likened editors and literary agents and publishers to door bitches. And I wanted to ask you, Mandy, what does it take these days to get through the door?
Oh, talent. Talent and, you got to have something. You always have had to have something. Do you mean into the gig of editing? As a writer, your job is to get into publishing. Your job as a writer is exactly the same as it is to be successful on the bookshelves. It's to make people sit up and take notice in whatever way is appropriate for the thing that you're doing. So, I mean, I edit quite a lot of crime. If I get crime through the door, I want it to feel exactly the same but really different.
Okay.
The job of genre is to do a particular thing really, really well, but in such a way that you don't realise you've read it before, basically.
Do you know straight away when you see that? Is there some magical feeling that you get?
Yeah, there's a really tingly feeling. It's like, oh, and I'll often pick something up, go, oh, up, this one knows what they're doing.
Right from the first page?
Right from the first sentence.
Okay, so we've got to nail those first sentences.
Well, yeah. It's really important to pay attention to your first sentence. Mm. But you've also got to carry it through. It's got to infuse the rest of the sentences as well, of course.
And so that's what you're looking for when you're picking up something like crime. What other – can you think of some examples of when things have just stood out straight away for you and you've just known straight from the – or is that just a prerequisite? You always just have to know.
You always do, really. But I'm. What flashed into my mind was not her first book, but the first book that Tex did with Eva Hornung was Dog Boy, and I was just like. And when I get one of those manuscripts across my desk, and I'll usually take it home and read it, and because I cycle commute, and I'll be on my bike the next morning, just like pedaling like fury to get to work and get. Cracking with flogging this to the rest of the company and making everyone as excited about it as I am. It's a tingly feeling. It's great.
Because that's your job then. The job then, once you've read that manuscript that really sings to you, you need to convince everyone else that you want to go with it.
Yeah, and, you know, usually it's a matter of just asking them to read it.
And then they get that same...
Usually they would. I mean, I have had occasions where I've been like, this is really special, have a look at this. And I'll get... one or two people, if I'm lucky enough to get people, multiple readers who are in the space where they can pay attention to it, I have had the experience where one or two of them are like, this is fantastic, I really love it, I get where you're coming from. And a couple of people might be, really annoyed me. And I actually think sometimes that's the mark of something that really sings, is that it sings a bit off key to some other people. It might not be for everyone. You know, something that really has personality might not be for everyone.
That's nice. That's a nice way to think about it, I think, too,
for
writers.
And I think what writers always need to remember when they're submitting to publishers is that there's a certain amount of commonality in what we think is good, but there's also a certain amount of disagreement.
Mm.
I've knocked back things. I've loathed things that were published very successfully by other people. And won awards and all that type of caper. And it's just when, I was wrong. But I always think of it that if I don't like something, I'm not the publisher for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so we do. We have these disagreements.
And there's an element, I suppose, of risk in there that a writer has taken. If they're going to split an opinion like that, then they have put themselves on the line.
Yeah, you don't want to bland everything out. I don't think that deciding... I don't think that any aspect of editorial work is best done by seeking lots of opinions.
Mm.
I think you find the opinion that appears to you to be productive for your work and consult that. I mean, that whole blanding out thing that happens when you're pleasing everybody. Yeah.
Mandy, you've talked about what sings. What are some of the common mistakes that you see writers do in the manuscripts that come into you that aren't successful?
Oh, spelling our names wrong in the cover.
Cringe.
Like... Get the fuck out of here. Come on.
Okay, so immediately put that one to the side.
No, we just go, Well, as a writer, you want people to approach your work with the sense that they wish to enjoy it.
Yep.
That they want to like it and find it good. And, you know, that's just a little error that narks and you think,
Yeah, set off on the wrong foot.
But it wouldn't stop me from signing a work of genius.
Yeah, okay.
So, mistakes that people make. I think that probably people take the wrong advice in their work sometimes. I think they do that focus group thing a bit, especially if they're in a writer's group or if they're going to manuscript assessment or something like that.
Interesting.
And I suspect that it tends to lead them into mechanistic error of the kind where you are explainy.
Yeah. When
I think writers respond to other people saying, I didn't understand this too readily.
And you can hear and see that in a manuscript.
I've had things come in from knowing that they've come in via a manuscript assessor or perhaps an agent, and you can see the finger marks of somebody going, I didn't get that. Can you just explain that a bit closer to the front?
Mm.
And it just, it's just like laying a big fat turd on the page. Am I allowed to put it that way?
You most certainly can. I think that resonates with people. People understand. That's interesting. So do you ever have the feeling that you want to be able to get your hands back then on the raw stuff?
Yep.
Do you ever ask for that?
I can't remember that I ever have, actually. But you do want to say to people, you know, that's where you get your big fat black lead pencil out and go, get rid of that, and that. If it seems obscure, then we'll backpedal a bit and we'll find a more elegant way of doing that. But just that, you know, he looked in the mirror and saw that he had a big fat black moustache.
Yeah.
Everything's fat and black today. I'm sorry about that, listeners. You get these things in your head.
Okay. That's very interesting. And I think very useful because of the advice we're so often given as writers, which is to, you know, get a whole lot of readers and take people's opinions on board, but that you often do get that.
Ask your listeners where they got bored. That's the only thing you need to know from your listeners.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that's it. Where did you get bored? Mandy, I wanted to ask then, is it gratifying for you to watch writers who you've worked with again and again get better over time?
Oh, yeah, it's lovely.
And can you see, did they do it in common ways or is each kind of uniquely better in their own way?
I think they often get more ambitious and then they manage to carry off that ambition, and that's just like, that's phenomenal. So it's like, oh, I have never understood how people can be so clever and so well organised as to write this kind of book, and you've just done it.
Yeah, wow.
You know, that's great.
That's the feeling you want.
That's the feeling you want. And it's not a feeling... I mean, there are certain things that I feel I can congratulate myself on as an editor. And a lot of editing is teaching in some ways. So, you know, I'm quite clear that there are things that I can teach a writer, and it's nice when they seem to have been taught.
Mm.
But just that thing of doing something wildly fantastic, that's them, you know. That's great.
How have you got better as an editor?
I've learnt not to second guess myself. I've learnt to just go with it. I have learnt to resist the temptation to pull back. Like, I do and say everything I think now. I have only ever regretted it when I didn't do that. There are times when you think, oh, I've asked them to do so much, I'll just let this one go. And you always regret it. And I've learned to ask authors to push back because I think that's really important, that it needs to be a dialogue. you know, I'm sort of a more mature person now. And so if I'm dealing with people, particularly people who are several years younger than me, I think it's not always natural for them to
push back.
No, you're wrong. And this is why you're wrong. But yeah. I do feel like I need to encourage people to do that.
Because it sets up a different dynamic.
Sets up a different dynamic. And, you know, you don't want to be a puppeteer.
Mm. I found a lovely quote, and I'll link to this, Robert Lutkins, who wrote an article about the structural edit of his debut book, novel, The Everlasting Sunday, and he wrote, "I had convinced myself of a romance in which my prose was perfect in its precipitant form. I had reached so deeply, tried so hard, this is how the book is, this is what I made. My editor challenged me, and I came to see that my thoughts had not been wrong, but were perhaps unfinished."
Mm.
And I wanted to ask if you saw that as part of your job in helping writers to finish their thoughts, finish what they've started.
Well, certainly structurally. Certainly structurally, because a lot of the time we get in these beautifully written things and it's not entirely satisfying as a sort of whole work of fiction. It's maybe the end's left hanging, or maybe they're, you know, just things that are kind of wrong about the structure and would compromise the reader's satisfaction. You know, you have things quite often where the climax takes too long to arrive.
Mm-hmm.
How like life.
Always.
Always. And so I think writers are often very, very clear about their prose and less clear about their structure, because a book is a novel is a big thing. It's really easy to get lost in.
Mm.
Can
you see, does the structure have a kind of a picture for you, a weight, a feeling? Like, when do you know just immediately when you've got to the end what's gone wrong there in the structure?
No, I sometimes have to think about that for a while. Often comes to me in the night.
Mm-hmm.
What I feel would feel immediately or fairly immediately is a kind of a sort of a feeling. I'm thinking of one book in particular where I got to the end and I just thought, and I was physically shaken by how upsetting I found it. And in that instance, I didn't really feel that there was an awful... In that instance, actually, the book needed to be trimmed at the start.
Okay.
Because it took too long to get there. It risked kind of boring the reader out before they got to this amazingly fantastic dramatic wave. So quite often it's kind of like, what is wrong with that? What do I need to tell this writer? Because I don't believe in just saying it doesn't work. That is completely freaking useless. So you've got to have something to offer.
A question or a solution?
Why?
Or
yeah. Why? Yeah, often. Or are you aware that you've written a thriller and that you haven't given a climax and an ending?
Yeah, because people don't write. I mean, writers don't, especially if, as they often are seeped in reading, then, or they think of themselves as a certain type of writer, they don't realise they've done the other thing.
This isn't even, for instance, I've got a manuscript on my desk at the moment from somebody I worked with a long time ago who's taken ages to write a new book, and I was like, no, I don't think it'll be very good. And it is. It's fantastically good. But it gets to about what you would consider to be about three quarters of the way through, and it just stops. It's just like it's crystal clear what needs to happen now.
Yep.
Why don't you just go and do it? And so, but that's not the book. It is.
Do you have in your head different ideal readers for different books?
No, it's just me. I only really care about me.
Yeah.
I think there are people who are probably really, really good at that. I think if I tried to imagine readers other than me, it would be... Well, it's really hard to imagine anyone cleverer than yourself.
It's very true.
In any very useful way, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, not... You know, I don't mean that there is no one. I mean that how would you imagine them? And so then you're either imagining yourself pretty much, or you're imagining somebody perhaps with what you imagine to be a bit less acumen or a bit less of something.
Yep.
I don't see how that could work, really. But I imagine it's a skill that I just don't have, you know.
I read an article that you'd written, a piece you wrote for MeAngin in 2011, and it was comforting, I think. There was part of it where you wrote that you can't read a manuscript the same way that you read a book for pleasure, because you said that an editor's read is a mean, carping, joyless thing. It aims to find fault, to pinpoint sources of disappointment. And you go on to say it aims, in short, to detect what needs to be changed. And I think that there's this feeling when writers get back that their beloved thing with all the marks all over it that is horrifying in the first instance. But then, of course, over time, you're so bloody grateful that someone's taken the time and knows your work so intimately.
Yep.
And it was comforting to know that you're reading with that purpose.
Yep. That's right. That's right. And sometimes, I mean, it's not always, you don't always get the negatives. If something's really structurally sound, nice voice, all that sort of thing, then that first read may just sweep you away, may just be fantastic. But always, 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 when you get your little close reading specs on and sharpen your pencil, there's so much that you can find to query or to... often word choice, you know, you can think of a word that would do that better. You can look at a sentence and go, you know, that sentence goes on much longer than it needs to. Let's just, you've said that, let's just stop.
Can you find pleasure in a final read of that work? Or I was interested in what your relationship becomes with those books once your work is done with them.
Sometimes you read something over the final time and you go, God, that's good.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can identify suggestions that you might have made yourself that have really worked, and that's lovely.
Yep.
So there can be a really lovely sense of satisfaction. I don't think I've ever gone back and read something a long time afterwards, though. Yeah. And that would be frightening anyway, because I'm ultimately responsible for proofreading and there are always proofing errors.
Always.
You just, you know, the thing that happens when you get a book back from the printer is you open it up and you spot a typo.
Straight away.
Yeah.
As is the way of the world. Mm. Mandy, I wanted to ask a little bit more about the author-editor relationship, and another line from that MeAngin piece, you said that, you know, we both understand that this may hurt, and I think writers will again identify with that feeling of hurt. Mm. How do you approach it from your side? You said before you always say now instead of holding back.
Yep. Editors approach their work according to their personality. When I'm teaching, I always say to the students that you've got two things. You've only got two tools as an editor. You've got your pencil and you've got yourself. That's all you have to draw on. So what you learn over time, I guess, is how to draw on what you are and what you can do and be. And my gift is absolutely not diplomacy. But when I work with people, they know that they are going to get the absolute unvarnished truth from me. And I think that... So when I work with an author, I'm asking them to be a grown-up about it.
And what are the ways then that writers can prepare themselves coming into that relationship? Because I think it's not necessarily something writers are taught.
No. And, you know, it's a very vulnerable state. Whenever you make something, it's like peeling a stick. There it is, absolutely naked and vulnerable, you know, and you are too. But as a writer, that's something you learn to deal with. You learn that the work is not you, exactly. Or at least that you don't have to be hurt through it in quite the same way. Sorry, what was the question?
What writers can bring, how writers prepare for that part of the writer-editor relationship and how they can be willing, I suppose, to take on board what you're giving so honestly.
Well, I think it's a difficult... I think it's a bit of a trick for a writer, actually. I think there's a very fine balance to be struck there. I think you need to approach it with a sense of openness but also confidence. Your editor is going to ask you to do things that you disagree with. And you might be right. And you've got to push back when you're right. Mm. So I guess ears wide open. That's what I want from writers. Ears wide open and just to trust that we're both interested in doing the best for the work.
Mm.
And to sort of follow your nose on that and have the discussion. You know, you can say no. You can say no and here's why. You can say, why do you want me to do that? I'm not getting that. You can say, and this is what I always look for, yeah, I can see why you want to change, but not that one, this one.
Yeah, okay.
That's the best thing an editor gets back from a writer. Not that one, this one.
Nice.
Mm.
I'm taking internal notes. If writers should be lucky enough to find themselves in a position where they have the joy of deciding between a couple of different publishers and editors, are there questions that they should be asking of editors or things they should be looking for to say, who am I going to work best with?
In terms of the publishing house, I think it's important to know what rights you're selling and whether that publishing house is well placed to exploit those rights.
Mm-hmm.
Not all publishers are great with international sales. At Text, we're very bullish about the fact that that's a thing for us.
Mm-hmm.
We hope that we're as good at it as we think we are. And we've had some success, so, you know, I'm sure people can make their own minds up about that. As far as the editorial relationship goes, I think you often get a chance to have a little bit of a phone call, and what you need to be listening for there is not really the kind of love song. It's very tempting to think that if people's singing you a love song that they actually get everything about you. Just listen a little bit harder than that and see if you feel like the relationship you're going to have with them would be fun and chewy, you know, in a good way.
It's an excellent description. I wanted to ask, as an editor, you've obviously watched a lot of books go out into the world.
Mm.
In your experience, what makes a book fly once it gets out there? What makes it experience the kind of success that writers lay awake at night dreaming of?
Luck. Almost. Well, luck, there's a certain amount of push that sales and marketing and publicity can give it. I mean, if you have a good publicity hook for your, like novels, first novels, there's often a story around the author and you might be in a good position to get some publicity. But second and subsequent novels, publicity is not going to be as big a thing typically. So in that case, hopefully you'll get some good marketing help. A lot of the time I think a novel's success depends on whether it's the kind of thing that people want at that time.
Mm.
A novel that's easy to pitch has a greater chance of finding the people who are going to like it. But look, I always think that if a novel's publishable at all, it probably has an audience of several thousand people, if only we could find them.
Mm.
You know, and it's very difficult to do that. So, you know, the publishing house has all these kind of tools and bits of stuff they do and bits of money they spend and things they think they'll do to bring this novel into the hands of the people who will want it. But sometimes the message you're trying to put out there is received and sometimes it's not.
It's interesting that you mentioned about that little bit of publicity around the story of a debut writer because a number of the people that we've spoken to have responded differently to that. Some like it and know that that's part of the deal and others think, oh, I don't want this whole story of me to be part of my book. Yep. It's a separate thing.
Yep.
How do you think first-time writers best exploit and or deal with that cult of the author kind of part?
Oh, I think if you get to participate in the cult of the author, you are very freaking lucky.
Yeah.
Embrace it.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, it's another place where establishing your own personal style, the way in which you can do that without it being horrible, and which may bring you even some fun or some sense of fulfillment, you know, that would be a good thing to explore. I'm not sure how you would do that, though.
Is it something that you talk about in your relationship with authors as you're doing that work? Is it something that you speak about and talk about, or you leave it up to the other department?
Yeah, no, that really is the business of the people who deal with the business.
But your advice would be to listen to those people.
Yeah, they know what they're doing. Yeah, and, you know, I've put heart and soul, my heart and soul, and of course exponentially more of the author's heart and soul into books that just sat there on shelves and never got bought or not by enough people. And it's horrible. You don't want it. So if you get the opportunity to participate in the cult of the author, I just reckon suck it up, because it's the best chance you've got. Excellent. And find a pitch. Find a pitch for yourself that you can bear. You know, find a persona that you can take to those festivals and bookshops.
And slip into that if need be.
Slip into it like a pair of jammies. Yep.
Yeah.
They people don't really want you. They purport to, but they just want a good story.
Yeah. As they always do. It would be remiss of me, seeing as I've got you here, not to ask you about all the dirty secrets about working with Catherine and the helpline.
So difficult. Such a prima donna.
She is, isn't she? Hopeless. I wanted to ask what you first admired about the helpline, or what stuck out to you.
Oh, it's just got this very dry, there's just, it's funny, you know? It's funny. And it's got this really straight, deadpan sort of style that kind of just busts out from time to time. I really love that about it, yeah.
Has she been an ideal editee?
She's been very good. We've asked a lot of Catherine, and she's responded magnificently. Like the manuscript is probably 30% longer than it was when it came in.
And is that an unusual thing to go longer, to write longer?
Yeah, fairly unusual. But because it's, is it genre? It's more or less genre. You know, it's sort of, it's not exactly a rom-com, but it's in that sort of segment.
Yeah.
And so it has certain requirements, as genre does, and to make those, sometimes you need a bit more length to make those requirements work. But mostly I feel like people don't know when they've done enough. Mostly I would be cutting.
To add words in quite a short time frame is a different skill again.
Well, it is, I think it's to Catherine's credit that she just sort of took the bit between herself and went with it. And because I didn't really know her very well as a writer, I was worried, because what can happen is that people just puff air into the thing.
Yeah.
But she came back with some really good stuff, and it just really added to the. It really added to the whole package, and it's great.
The whole package, which we are so excited to see very soon. Yeah. I wanted to ask then your advice, you know, for Catherine. We've been asking all of the first-time writers to give advice to Catherine, but also to writers in general and emerging writers, about how to get through that door, how to do well with their manuscript, how to go out into the world with it then and make it fly.
You need to be persistent. Your work, there's three things that can happen. Your work is not publishable by anyone after you've shown it to all of them. They don't think it's publishable, in which case you need to write something else. Mm-hmm. Or it's publishable by everyone, in which case you'll be in a bidding war, and good on you. Or it's it will find its publisher if you persist. So you've got to, if you're not in the second category, I suppose, if you're not in the middle of a bidding war, then you just try everyone. And if you're not going to find your publisher, then you are going to write something else. Or you know, going to be a film director or something instead. You know. I think. I think don't flog away at the same thing indefinitely.
Hmm.
I think there is a time to put things away and just go, you know what, I can't see that anymore. I'm a great believer in letting a manuscript go cold before you assess what it actually is.
As the writer, giving
yeah,
it time?
Yeah, let it go cold. You don't know what it is until it's settled. And, you know, I mean, if you could give something 6 months, I reckon that'd be great.
And then you go back to it and you should
you
know.
Read it.
Just, yeah. And you work
what is
out
it?
What's in it.
What is it? Because your first draft, as everyone will say, I'm sure they have on this podcast, is you don't know what the book is until you finish the first draft. And then you can go back and write it. And I know people who won't redraft. And, you know, they're very dependent on doing something spectacular right out of the gate, which is
really
a tall
hard.
Order. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let it go cold.
Yeah, absolutely.
It has not been cold at all talking to you, Mandy. I have taken so many notes inside my head and I hope that our listeners will too. Thank you so much for sharing your editing wisdom with us on the first time.
Thank you for listening. It's been lovely.
Thanks, Mandy. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre and RMIT School of Media and Communication.